Welcome. Thank you for coming, and especially, special welcome to those who are here for the first time. We're delighted that you've come to join us. What we're doing today is we're in the third of three talks from Luke's chapter 15 and 16. So we're just picking up the next section of Jesus' teaching. Okay, now Christian parents are funny creatures, aren't they? Christian parents are funny creatures. Some of them, maybe even yours, they worry about you now that you've come to uni, the big bad university, and how you might come to ruin. Ironically, the very things that you probably love about uni, independence, parents no longer peeking over your shoulder, are the very reason why they're worried. But I wonder, can you guess exactly what is the specific nature of their fear? For those Christian parents who worry about their kids in the wilderness of university, what is the mischief they fear that you'll get up to? What are they worried might cause the shipwreck to your faiths? So I want you to chat with someone nearby, and maybe you can talk about your own Christian parents, but if you don't have Christian parents or they're not worried, speculate about why some Christian parents might be worried when their kids come to uni. So have a chat for a couple of minutes in pairs or groups of three. Go for it. It's fun, isn't it, to talk about how weird Christian parents are. I could be wrong about this, but I suspect at the start of the year, around orientation time, at least some Christian parents worry that their kids are going to get into trouble around alcohol and sex. Does that shock anyone? Alcohol and sex? What's the issue there? Well, too much alcohol can lead to too little self-control, and yes, poor sexual choices can sometimes follow. And sometimes when you've gone down that path, it can sometimes be hard to come back. And that is why Jesus does give strong warnings in the Gospels about sexual immorality. It is a danger that for those who would walk the path of discipleship need to be aware of. However, did you know that there's something that Jesus warns against far more often than sexual immorality? He warns against it far more often, which probably suggests it's even more dangerous. And this is something I'm guessing your parents never even thought about, be worried about. But I'm going to suggest today, and if Jesus is right, there is a greater threat to young men and women when they turn up to uni. I wonder if you can guess what I'm talking about. Anyone know? Anyone speculate what I'm thinking of? Yes?
Maybe
swaying from Christianity. That's certainly a danger. It's not the one I had in mind. Yep, thank you, Cassie. Yep, anyone else want to have a go? Pride, that's certainly a danger. It's not the one I was thinking of. Thanks for that. Yep. Yeah, go.
If you want us to say, mistreatment because we're Christians.
No, that's not what I want you to say. Okay, you haven't guessed. Sexual immorality, that's a problem. You know what's a bigger problem? Financial immorality. Anyone surprised? Yes. See, it brings us to one of the more surprising of the parables that Jesus ever told. And Jared is going to get up and read the first 12 verses for us. Over to you, brother. Oops, let me just get that out of the way. Yep.
Yeah, all right.
Go for it.
Right, hello. So we'll be reading from Luke 16, and we've been doing verses 1 to 12. Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer.' The manager said to himself, 'What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that, when I lose my job, people will welcome me into their houses.' So he called in each of his master's debtors. He asked the first, 'How much do I owe my master?' 800 gallons of olive oil," he replied. The manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Then he asked the second, "How much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat," he replied. He told him, "Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own?
Thank you, Jarrett. So the parables we've been looking at the last few weeks were pretty memorable, weren't they? The parables of the lost. They were memorable because they resonated so deeply with our experience. But they also provided this astonishing picture of God's passionate love for the lost. And once you've been exposed to that view, it's hard to forget it. And now Jesus continues. The setting hasn't changed. He continues to teach. He continues to teach in parables. And yet again, he gives another memorable parable. But this time it's memorable for a different reason, isn't it? It's memorable because the main character is dishonest and yet he's praised. Did that puzzle anyone? It's odd, isn't it? However, let me set a bit of a broader context. Like in so many of Jesus' parables, once again what we have is a master who entrusts responsibility to his servant, to his steward. I think the NIV has manager, but same idea, okay? And like someone in the previous parable that we looked at last week, this manager, this steward, is wasteful as well, isn't he? And his wastefulness doesn't go unnoticed. So you notice there, verse 2, he's called to give an account for what he's done. And the prospect of this looming judgment brings a wonderful clarity to his thinking. As the crap is about to hit the fan, he thinks, oh, wow, I've got to make some big decisions here, don't I? He says to himself, I'm in trouble. What can I do to escape this awful mess that I'm in? And I love how realistic he is about himself. He's worked kind of in white-collar work. He's, you know, like a bit like a uni graduate. He's worked with finances, managing the estate. And he doesn't want to have to go back to doing blue-collar work, does he? He doesn't want to have to go to digging ditches. He doesn't want to have to start living life on the streets, verse 3. He's a little bit of a snob, if you haven't noticed. It kind of makes you wonder what he'd think of you and I here at RMIT, the Working Man's University. He probably wouldn't have liked us much at all. He probably would have been up the road at that other university that we won't name. So this steward, he's wasted, hasn't he, his master's possessions. But notice he's not going to waste any time now to try and think his way out of this mess. So do you see what he does? He devises a strategy that should allow him to continue to live in the manner to which he is accustomed. Do you see what he's going to do? He's going to cook the books. He's going to fiddle the numbers. And he's going to win favour with his master's creditors. Can you imagine the conversation? You owe what? I must have misheard you. Because I think you meant considerably less than what you just said. Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink. Say no more. Do we have an understanding? Do we have a working relationship? See, the debts are reduced at the master's expense. In the first case, it's by both times it's significant. First time 50%, second time 20%. Why the difference? I've got no idea. But then the judgment day comes. It comes upon him and it takes a turn that we don't expect, doesn't it? Because his strategic dishonesty is commended. So what's going on? I mean, how can that be? Because the parable pulls no punches about just how unscrupulous this steward is. Did you notice that he never denies the accusation made against him? He never denies it. He never denies that he's been prodigal, that he's been wasteful. And Jesus explicitly describes him in verse 8 as dishonest. Furthermore, his dishonesty is never endorsed, is it? See, look again at verse 8. Look closely at what the master says. He's not praised for his dishonesty. He's commended for his shrewdness. Does anyone know what the word shrewd means? Clever, smart, yeah, that's right, yeah. So he's not praised for his ethics, he's praised for his strategic thinking, okay? So he's clever, he's strategic, but that doesn't mean that he's good. And the master knows that, remember? He knows that he's a dishonest steward. So just quickly, if there's any confusion about how to apply this parable, let me clear up any possible misconceptions. Jesus is not endorsing telling lies. Elsewhere he explains that lying is not just sinful, it's positively satanic. After all, do you remember, Satan is the father of lies. That's what the teaching of Jesus is. Jesus is not pro-lying, okay? Furthermore, again, if you're in any doubt, you shouldn't be financially ripping people off, okay? Because that is a fundamental failure to love. And for the disciple of Christ, it's always better to be ripped off than to be the one doing the ripping off. Do you remember what Jesus said? If someone asks for your shirt, what do? You give them your coat. Yeah, you give them your coat as well. You let them rip you off. Better they rip you off than you rip them off. So then, why does the master here commend the dishonest steward? Well, it's not because he's some kind of moral hero that we should follow in every respect. No, he's commended because for all his obvious faults, he has a kind of strategic wisdom that we can learn from. He has a kind of forward planning, strategic wisdom, especially when it comes to money. Did you notice that? Do you see the conclusion that Jesus draws at the end of verse 8? He talks about how those in the world, they often have a people savvy when it comes to money. They understand that money can make you friends. But is that something that we understand? Is that something that we understand? You see, this steward, what does he do? He looks to his future. He was making friends in his creditors' homes, wasn't he? Is it possible that we might also look to the future and make friends? Gain a rich welcome into the heavenly home. Verse 9. Into the heavenly home. You're beginning to see where this teaching's going? You see, what does it say when we only use the money that God has entrusted into our care for the now? If I only ever spend money on my comforts, my entertainment, and my security, what does that say about how I think about the future? Sometimes we think of our money as our money, don't we? And if it's our money, therefore we can do with it what we want. But of course, that's not the case, is it? It's not our money. It is someone else's property. Do you see that in verse 12? It's someone else's property. It's the gift of God. It's a gift on loan. Of course, if you don't really believe in a future beyond this life, then obviously all your spending will focus on the here and now. That makes sense. But believers, us disciples, we're meant to have a longer term view of the future, aren't we? And I do get it. It is hard when you're young because life seems to stretch out before you kind of almost endlessly, doesn't it? And it's easy, therefore, to focus all your energy and your dreams and your resources, including your cash, on the next 20 or 30 years. I get that fully. But, of course, do you see the direction of Jesus' teaching? There is also eternity to keep in mind when it comes to how you use your money. And eternity stretches out just a little bit longer than the next 20 or 30 years. Now you see, unbelievers, they know how to plan for the future, so why can't we? Let me assure you, as an old man, this life will slip by faster than you can imagine. It really will. You know, I know you can't believe this, but it doesn't actually feel all that long ago that I was in your seats, that I was a student. Yes, there were universities 30 years ago. Hard to believe, isn't it? Yeah, that's right. And from this point onwards, what you will find is that life will begin to accelerate and the years will just go by faster than you can imagine. You see, if you really believe in the eternal future, the life to come, then see what Jesus is saying? Get wise and show it with the money that he bestows. Make sense? Use your money, in other words, in light of your future. Use your money to make friends for eternity. Those who will welcome you, verse 9, into eternal dwellings. Who are these future friends that Jesus is talking about? Well, they are, of course, fellow believers who've been blessed because you decided, strategically decided, to invest some of your money in the work of the gospel. in the kingdom to come. You may not ever meet them in this life, but be assured you will meet them and experience their gratitude in the life to come. You know, there are fellow Christians that you guys will be thanking in eternity. Fellow Christians, you will be thanking in eternity when you get to heaven. Why do I say that? Because this work at RMIT Christian Union is effectively funded by those who came before you. Graduates support me to stick around and teach the Bible. See, their experience, they love their time at Christian Union so much. They appreciated how much they changed and grew. They actually want you to share the same experience. How cool is that? They put their money where their mouth is. See what Jesus is saying? We need to learn shrewdness or wisdom when it comes to money. Or if you like, it's the same point, but really slightly different category in verses 10 to 12. We need to learn not just wisdom or shrewdness, but we need to learn to be trustworthy with the money that we're given. You see, God has richly bestowed on us a certain amount of worldly wealth, a certain amount of worldly riches, hasn't he? In fact, here in Australia, more than most compared to other countries. We are financially blessed indeed. But I guess the question is, what will we do with that financial blessing? Will we prove faithful? Will we show ourselves ready and eager for the true riches, otherwise known as treasure in heaven? Eternal rewards. Okay, so we've worked through a kind of memorable but kind of slightly unusual parable. We're going to move on, still talk about the theme of money. But before we do so, does anyone have any questions before we move on to the next section of Jesus' teaching? Is anything sticking in your gut about what's been said that you want to raise? Or you're far too polite? Yeah. Anyone got a comment or a question? Yeah, go Ben.
So what would that kind of look like in our lives today, like while we're at uni, what would investing in our...
Yep. 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 Do you want to answer that question, Cassie?
Oh, I didn't hear it.
Okay. Well, Ben's question is, what would it look like for us to invest in the kingdom, in making future friends? Well, I think it means it's most Christians feel some obligation to give financial support to Christian work. Well, I think that's what it means. It means supporting work that will change the world, that will change people's lives. Yeah, I think. Thanks for that. Cassie, you want to make a comment?
Yeah, I just want to, like, I think on the note of money and what I'm sort of getting from this parable,
yep,
is that it doesn't all necessarily come from, like, physical money that you might get paid from your parents or your boss or whatever. I feel like it's sort of also teaching us to invest in our friends and invest,
yep,
in our relationships and choose wisely,
yep,
who you're investing in. Obviously, as a your sort of role in the world is to, you know, share your knowledge and share God's love and his gospel.
Yes.
But obviously also thinking about who you're investing when it comes to your
yep,
friendships,
yep,
your work relationships, your marriages, everything.
Yeah, no, I think there's some wisdom that
not just like,
yep,
physical money.
Yep, that's right.
You know, into your,
yep,
bank account type of thing.
Yep.
But
yep,
also
yep.
And
yeah, thanks, Cass.
Where to invest that?
Yeah, no, that's helpful. That's helpful. I think I get the gist. So, yeah, we should be investing in relationships generally and in people. I think that's really right. We should also, I think he is talking about money as well. So it's a bit of both. So I think you're right, but I think he's also talking about our money. So let's move on. Verses 13 to 15. Jared, maybe from where you are. Yep, loud voice. Yep.
No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. The Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. He said to them, "You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of men, but God knows your hearts. What is highly valued among men is detestable in God's sight."
Thank you, brother. So notice again, we on the theme of money, we again have a servant and a master. Notice it's not two masters. That wouldn't work, would it? It's one master alone. And it's not really exactly rocket surgery, is it? One master, servant, serves one master. But once you start to think about its application, as Jesus does here, especially in regard to money, these six simple words, no servant can serve two masters, they become incredibly challenging, don't they? So let me ask you this question in light of what Jesus says here. Do you love God or do you hate him? And what does your attitude to money suggest? Yeah, discuss in your small groups for a few minutes that cheerful topic. Do you love God or hate him? Have a chat. Okay, well, I'll give you a chance to keep talking about that later on. But if I can cut off those cheerful, jolly conversations for the moment, that'd be great. I'm going to suggest that the problem for most of us, generally speaking, is that we actually do want two masters, don't we? We actually do want God and money. I mean, isn't that why we came to uni in the first place? To get ahead, to make a career, to secure your financial future, to begin your service to the mighty dollar? Now, of course, don't get me wrong, you can go to uni, get a good job, earn good money without being in service to money. That is possible. Without loving money. Because money itself is not the problem, is it? It's the love of money that's the problem. So that's right. However, how can you tell when you've shifted into love money mode or to serve money mode? It's hard, isn't it? So let me raise some scenarios and you can see how they interact with where you're at. I think your attitude to giving is a good place to start because that's where Jesus starts here, isn't it? So are you investing in the eternal future and the lives of others, or are you simply investing your money only in yourself? Who do you love? Your giving is one indicator. Your income is another. What do I mean by that? Well, I suspect a number of you have casual jobs. If that's the case, let me ask you, do you take on every extra shift that you can?
Yes, or I wouldn't be able to.
Yeah, now, I'm aware that some of us have to. Yeah, so some of us do have to. But a lot of us don't. Do we? So let me ask you the question, would you ever say no to work, and effectively say no to money, so that you can give more time to God and to other people? Again, if this doesn't apply to you because you have to work, that's fine. This is a word of challenge for the rest of us. Who do you love? Speaking of work, why not tell your bosses tonight that you're not going to work on the weekend of April 19 to 21? Why? So you can join us at kickoff camp and invest in Christian friendships, invest in Christian growth, rather than just investing in your bank balance. That'd be good for you, wouldn't it? But it'd also be good for your bosses. What would it communicate to them? That you really love God more than money, wouldn't it? If you love God more than money, your degree will be important, won't it? But it won't be all important. So you'll be able to embrace the other reasons why God brought you here to RMIT. It's not all about that future paycheck, is it? So you'll prioritise meeting with Christians even when semester gets busy. Both for your encouragement and for theirs. And you won't, of course, forget about God's passion for the lost. Remember? We've been talking about that the last 2 weeks. Those you sit beside in class. You won't be so focused on your marks and your career that you'll forget about them. Can I suggest, I don't know if this breaks Christian taboos, but if you think that God only cares about your career, then you're not actually listening to Jesus. Do you see what he's saying here? Career and cash are often in competition for your heart. Isn't that what he's saying? Of course, there are other indicators, aren't there? Like, are you content with what you've got? Like, are you happy with the fact that you don't actually have much money now? Is that okay? Or are you somewhat obsessed with what others around you have? Did you know that every time you watch an ad, you're being tempted to love money and hate God? But you don't believe that, do you? See, most Christians know to be on their guard when it comes to sexual immorality. Most young men, Christian young men, know that they shouldn't move into a brothel. That's not going to help their sexual purity, is it? But there's a greater danger, financial immorality. Are you aware? It's true we live in a sexualized culture, but you know, we also live in a greedified culture, don't we? Greedified. And most of the time we don't even see the danger. See what Jesus is doing here? He's warning his disciples and he's warning us not to end up like the Pharisees. Self-righteous, angry at God's gracious purpose for the lost, and loving money, verse 14. For you see, this is not just a problem with the wicked world out there, is it? The love of money is a problem in organized religion. Is anyone shocked to hear that? The love of money is a problem even within the church. Surely not. And notice what Jesus says, verse 15. It's detestable. It's hateful to God. It's an abomination. And that is a really strong word that's used in the Old Testament of only the most serious misconduct. Things like idolatry, fancy that. Or having sex with an animal. You see how the strong language he's using about the love of money, about the service of money? This is a high-stakes game, according to Jesus. To love money or to serve money is to risk offending God deeply and to destroy your faith over time. Now, of course, the Pharisees, in their defense, would argue, well, why can't riches and righteousness go together? Why can't we have both? I mean, Jesus, have you ever heard of Abraham? Job? Solomon? The Vatican? Joel Osteen? Let's read on verses 16 to 18, please, Jared.
The law and the prophets were proclaimed until John. Since that time, the good news of the kingdom of God is being preached, and everyone is forcing his way into it. It is easier for heaven and earth to disappear than for the least stroke of a pen to drop out of the law. Anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery, and the man who marries a divorced woman commits adultery.
Thank you, brother. Do you see the point Jesus made? You see how that flows on so naturally from what he's just been talking about? It is actually connected, because you know what comes straight after this teaching, this little stuff about the law and the prophets? We have another parable about money. So Jesus hasn't left the topic behind. He is still talking. What's the point he's making? His point is that the times, they are a-changing. So even if it's true that righteousness and riches were connected under the old covenant, we're now in the new age, the gospel age, and everything now has to be considered in the light of Jesus. Of course, it's also true that in one sense, not the smallest piece of the Old Testament will disappear, verse 17, not because the Old Testament is God's final word, but rather because it is God's forward-pointing word. It is God's looking ahead to Jesus' word, the word who fulfills and completes that former word. And so Jesus is saying here, if you're going to use the Old Testament against Jesus, that's why the Pharisees are sneering. They think the Old Testament clearly says it's okay to pursue righteousness and riches. And they sneer at him. But you see what Jesus is saying back to them? If you're going to try and use the Old Testament against me, you clearly haven't understood what you've been reading. You need to go back and reread the Old Testament once again in the light of my teaching. Take, for example, divorce. Again, doesn't seem to be connected, but it is. You see, in the Old Testament, divorce was permitted. Why was divorce permitted? Well, because God knew that human sinfulness could and would ruin marriages. And so permitting divorce under certain conditions was about damage limitation, especially for women. You see, in a culture where marriage was, for most women, their primary career, what were they meant to do if their husbands discarded them? It left them really, really vulnerable. So there's this kind of concession to deal with this messy situation. But what the Pharisees had done is they had exploited that concession, and for some of them, they were justifying divorce on any and every ground. She burnt my dinner. That's enough. Out you go. That's actually what they said. That's one of the examples they gave. But notice what Jesus is doing? He's overturning all that for his disciples. He's tightening all those loopholes. It's a new age, and he expects new ways of living. Again, is he undermining the Old Testament? No, he's restoring and clarifying it. Because the Old Testament has a high view of marriage, doesn't it? From Genesis 2 through to Malachi 2. In the Bible, in the Old Testament, marriage is for life, and it also creates new families. And so in most circumstances, divorce from your spouse is no more possible than divorcing a sibling. Can you divorce your brother? Will your sister? Will your mum? Of course you can't. And to seek to do so is the deepest betrayal. Now, you might have thought that's a lot of stuff to absorb in 30 seconds, the Bible's teaching on marriage and divorce. If you want more, come to Kickoff Care, because we're looking at the Song of Songs and we're looking at marriage and sex and all those sort of stuff. But I just want you to see Jesus' point here. He's saying you cannot hide behind the Old Testament to justify your own righteousness. I don't know if you've ever heard prosperity teachers in church. You know what they do? They keep quoting the Old Testament. But you cannot hide behind the Old Testament to justify your own personal unrighteousness, whether it's in regard to marriage and divorce or whether it's in regard to riches. Because what Jesus does is he takes what's implicit in the Old Testament and then he brings it to its full flowering in his own teaching. So you can sneer or scoff all you like, it's still true that you cannot serve both God and money. Okay, I'm going to finish on that point. I'm going to say a prayer and then Ben's going to explain what's happening next. Please pray with me. Dear Father, we thank you for the teaching of Jesus here on the topic of money. Please help us to see the danger of the love of money, of the service of money. Please help us to be aware that it wrecks countless Christian lives over the course. Please help us to be clear about our hearts and our attitudes to money, and please help us to love you and not to love money. Please help us, we pray, and forgive us in Jesus' name. Amen.